Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Last December, San Francisco Mayor London Breed had had enough. Parts of the city were in the grip of a crisis. It wasn't COVID. No, because the city had responded well to the pandemic. Mayor Breed was furious about the lack of response to the fentanyl-fueled opioid epidemic.
What I see is far, far worse. Just imagine if you had to walk your kids down the streets of the Tenderloin every single day with people shooting up, selling drugs, and because the sidewalks were so packed with people, you had to walk out onto the street in incoming traffic on a regular basis.
San Francisco's Tenderloin District isn't some far-flung neighborhood on the city's edge. It's barely a block away from City Hall. Mayor Breed painted a vivid picture of just how much neighborhood residents are suffering.
You got these brand new playgrounds where you don't even feel comfortable walking your kids to play in them because of everything that they see around them, where you don't feel safe. The PTSD, the challenges, the cramped conditions, the nasty streets. And when I say nasty, full of feces and urine that Department of Public Works is cleaning every single day, but it comes back just a few hours later.
Mayor Breed was fed up, and she made it clear.
That is not okay. That is not acceptable. And it's time that the reign of criminals who are destroying our city, it is time for it to come to an end. And it comes to an end when we take the steps to be more aggressive with law enforcement, more aggressive with the changes in our policies, and less tolerant of all the that has destroyed our city.
By the way, Mayor London Breed is no stranger herself to the personal devastation wrought by drugs and crime. She grew up in San Francisco public housing just a few blocks west of the Tenderloin. Her brother is currently serving a prison sentence for manslaughter. And in 2006, Mayor Breed's younger sister died of a drug overdose. But in the 11 months since Mayor Breed made that speech, she says very little has actually changed. And a few weeks ago, public radio station KQED asked her what she meant by BS. Mayor Breed said she was frustrated that drug dealers, quote, have more rights than the law-abiding families of the Tenderloin. And she said drug dealers in the Tenderloin come from a very specific country.
Come from Honduras. And when a lot of the arrests have been made, you have the public defender's office who are using the law to say you're racial profiling, right? And it's nothing racial profile about this. It's we all know it. It's the reality. It's what you see. It's what's out there.
Instant outrage. Activists and some residents accused Mayor London Breed of racism. She promptly apologized. Well, this is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we've been wondering, was Mayor Breed wrong about the path that deadly fentanyl travels into the United States and who's bringing it into the country? What is the actual sophisticated system, the logistics and business of the international opioid drug trade that's making fentanyl so easily available and so deadly to people of every race and ethnicity, not just in San Francisco, but in cities across the country? And if Mayor Breed wasn't wrong, what does that mean about efforts or the needed efforts to fight the opioid epidemic in the United States now? Well, it's that network and that system that we're going to try to understand today. Well, we'll start with Randy Shaw. He's director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, a nonprofit supportive housing provider, and the author of a history of the Tenderloin District as well. He also runs a blog at beyondcron.org. Randy Shaw, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Randy, let me start off with this question. In hearing, again, Mayor Breed's speech from last December, you almost come away with, like, it's such a fantastical description that she's giving of day-to-day life in the Tenderloin. For people who aren't familiar with it, it may defy belief. But if you were to walk outside right now a couple of blocks around the neighborhood, what would you see?
Well, just to be clear, Mayor Breed got more publicity for the Tenderloin than ever. And every national and even international media covered her Tenderloin emergency order from last December. And when you hear the words that you just ran, your listeners should know that it was not followed by any increased police activity. No more police were given to the Tenderloin after that emergency order than before. No actual actions were taken to respond to the mayor's emergency order, even though they were promised. So it became almost a cruel joke on the Tenderloin that they were promised that all these things were going to change. If you walk out now, most of the Tenderloin is fine. Mm-hmm. The problem is you have some blocks that are so out of control, dominated by open air drug markets, that people see those blocks and they are fearful for the neighborhood. And people who live in the neighborhood can't walk through the neighborhood without hitting some of those blocks. So the real question is, how does a progressive city like San Francisco install a drug containment zone in the last remaining multiracial low-income community in the city?
Wait, so tell me more about that. A drug containment zone, is that what needs to be there, or is that's what's there now?
Well, I think if we look in practical terms, last almost a year ago, right about a few weeks before the mayor gave the Tenderloin emergency order, there was a high-profile viral video of thefts coming from the Louis Vuitton hat store, the wealthy bags from Union Square. The mayor dispatched 80 police officers to Union Square, a very upscale shopping district a few blocks from the Tenderloin. And they stayed there for a month. And if you go to Union Square now, you'll still see police officers and police cars everywhere to protect the property at Union Square. We never got a similar response ever to the drug operations in the Tenderloin. Mm. So at some point, and I think we've reached that point, you have to conclude that this is what the city wants it to be. The mayor continually makes statements about how upset she is, but she's the mayor and hasn't allocated the resources to solve the problem.
I see. So you say she's not doing enough to allocate resources or even to encourage law enforcement to change how they're operating in the Tenderloin?
Exactly. If you talk to the police chief, he'll agree with everything. Yes, it's terrible what's going on. It's awful. But why don't they solve it then? And if it happened in a more affluent neighborhood, we all know drug dealers would not be allowed to stay there for a day. Mm-hmm. So it isn't that San Francisco's incapable. At some point, you have to decide, they've just decided to allow these drug activities in a low-income neighborhood where people don't have the political donations and the power. And this way, they can identify it as, well, we're containing it in the Tenderloin so we don't have it in more affluent neighborhoods.
Okay. So then tell me a little bit more about why you think that Mayor Breed, law enforcement, city attorneys are, in your words, allowing this to happen. Is it just simply because is it simply because of the low income? I mean, or tell me more.
Well, yeah. Well, the Tenderloin, in my book on the Tenderloin, mm-hmm. I talk about the history, and the Tenderloin was a very prosperous neighborhood for a long time until really the 1960s, and it started a 40-year decline. It started reviving under Mayor Lee in 2011, and had there not been COVID, none of this would have happened. But I think what's historically, there's always been people who felt like, well, let it happen in the Tenderloin so it doesn't happen in Knob Hill or it doesn't happen mm-hmm. in Noe Valley or the other upscale neighborhoods. And I think that, you know, we have district elections, so most of the supervisors don't represent the Tenderloin. So politically, it's easier for them just to not have to deal with it and to feel like that's someone else's problem. And then we have this whole crazy view that says that if you arrest drug dealers, you're criminalizing poverty. But the people who's impacted by drug dealers are all poor. The Tenderloin is all low income. We have no single family homes. It's a low income area. Permanently affordable housing in most of the neighborhood, so there's no risk of gentrification. So it's really a hypocritical policy choice by a city that prides itself on being progressive.
Mm. Now, when you said if it weren't for COVID, none of this would happen, I'm looking at the overdose death rates for the city of San Francisco. In 2021, 625 people died from drug overdoses. It was more than 700 in 2020. The city itself acknowledges that overdose rates are are still 40% above pre-pandemic levels. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I'm saying that COVID closed down businesses when it first started in March of 2020. And so it created empty spaces for drug dealers to proliferate. There were not this level of drug dealers prior to COVID because businesses were thriving and the city was operating and people were there. But once the city kind of emptied out for that, you know, after March 2020, when spots are empty, it invites opportunities for illegal activities. So had that not occurred, and it's not just the Tenderloin, it's nearby areas which are also taken over. And the city funds harm reduction programs that give out needles and encourage drug use. They've spent $30 million on a linkage center where the people can go to shoot up drugs, and the drug dealers stand outside and sell them the drugs, and they go in and shoot it up on the city property. So there's been a lot written about and talked about the nonsensical approach to safety in San Francisco, and it's all true.
So we have to take a break here in just a little bit, Randy, but let me zoom back in on something you said a little earlier. You know, we're trying to understand the path that these opioids, and particularly fentanyl, takes to neighborhoods and districts like the Tenderloin. You heard that Mayor Breed had to apologize when she singled out Hondurans as being some of the dealers in the Tenderloin. From your firsthand experience living there, was she wrong or not?
Well, I work there. I don't live there. Everybody knows the U.S. attorney determined that there's a Honduran drug cartel on the Tenderloin. I think what got her in trouble was the people said that she was implying all Honduran immigrants were drug dealers, which obviously isn't true. But it's undisputed from this U.S. attorney's office about Honduran drug gangs based in Oakland who then send people to the Tenderloin to sell drugs.
Well, Randy Shaw, who runs the blog beyondcron.org and director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, just stand by here for just a second. We're trying to understand the network and the system that gets drugs into neighborhoods like San Francisco's Tenderloin and what to do about it. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand the system, the network that gets deadly opioids, particularly fentanyl now, into neighborhoods such as San Francisco's Tenderloin District and the devastation that the presence of all of those drugs is wreaking on those neighborhoods, and what needs to be done to stop it. I'm joined today by Randy Shaw. He's director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, a nonprofit supportive housing center in San Francisco's Tenderloin. He also runs a blog called beyondcron.org. Now, earlier, we heard some tape of Mayor London Breed, San Francisco's mayor, when she was speaking at a press conference about a year ago, last December, and she had said that the city needed to be, quote, less tolerant of all the BS in the Tenderloin, although, of course, she didn't say BS. She said something more specific than that. Well, a few weeks ago, KQED's Marisa Lagos asked Mayor Breed why she put it so starkly.
I was angry. I was frustrated. I had met with all these families who, many were immigrant families, who were telling me stories and in tears. And I'm like, people are living like this every day in San Francisco.
Walks from City
Hall. Why is this okay? Why do people who deal drugs have more rights than people who try to get up and go to work every day and take their children to school?
But what exactly did the mayor mean by more rights? Well, she gave KQED an example.
Let's talk about the reality of the situation. There are unfortunately, a lot of people who come from a particular country come from Honduras, and a lot of the people who are dealing drugs happen to be of that ethnicity. And when a lot of the arrests have been made, you have the public defender's office who are using the law to say you're racial profiling, right? And it's nothing racial profile about this. It's we all know it. It's the reality. It's what you see. It's what's out there.
Well, those remarks from London Breed sparked a backlash from some progressive and Hispanic groups in San Francisco. So the mayor quickly issued a statement apologizing, saying, quote, "I want to apologize to the Latino community for what I said and how I said it. In trying to explain what is happening in the Tenderloin, I failed to accurately and comprehensively discuss what is an incredibly complex situation in our city and in Central America," end quote. Well, Carlos Solorzano, president of the San Francisco Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, told local NBC affiliate KNTV that he accepted Mayor Breed's apology, saying she meant well, but...
"We also have to understand that we're not naming only one ethnicity, that is not good enough anymore. With all the turmoil that we have with between the Latino community, the African-American, the Asian communities, we need to work more together. So we need to be more conscious of what we say when we're pointing fingers, especially on that."
But Solorzano also told KNTV something else, that when his group, the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, surveyed dealers on 8 blocks of the Tenderloin back in 2018, so even before the COVID pandemic, more than half were teenagers from Honduras. Well, joining us now is Leighton Woodhouse. He's with us from Oakland, California. He's a Bay Area freelance journalist who's reported extensively on the drug trade in the Tenderloin. Leighton, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, I just want to spend a minute here talking in detail about what Mayor Breed said to KQED and then the backlash. Can you describe to us what happened and what that was like?
Well, Mayor Breed just stated some factual reality about the situation. She should not have apologized for it, in my opinion. What she said was that the drug dealers in the Tenderloin are from Honduras. Now, the racism charge misinterpreted what she said as the drug dealers are all ethnically Honduran. Yes, they are ethnically Honduran, but that's not the point. The point is that they're Honduran nationals, the people who are from Honduras. And this is just acknowledging reality, and we can't solve this problem until we start to acknowledge reality. The drug dealers in the there are drug dealers in the Tenderloin who are not Honduran, but they're usually very low-level drug dealers, people who are maybe selling their prescription Xanax on the side to support their drug habits. But the drug trade in the Tenderloin is driven by the organized professional drug dealers. And those folks are supplied by the Mexican Sinaloa cartel. And the Sinaloa cartel recruits people from young men and women, actually now increasingly, from Honduras. They smuggle them into the United States, and they sell drugs on San Francisco streets as well as several other American cities. It's very organized. These folks work in shifts. They start their shift at 8 in the morning. They can't be late. They never leave their post. They have they have food delivered to them by their associate. They are not addicted to drugs. If they become addicted to drugs, they get cut off by the cartel because they become unreliable. This is a professional organization, and the folks who are dealing on the street are from the country of Honduras. Now, Mayor Breed brought it up, not because she didn't even bring it up herself. She was responding to the public defender, who was the one who made this point in the first place, by saying that one particular SFPD officer who was arresting these dealers was racist because he disproportionately was arresting Latinos. She was responding to that charge of racial profiling and saying that's ridiculous because if all the dealers are from one country, then, you know, the Sinaloa cartel does not practice diversity, equity, and inclusion in its hiring practices. If they're all from one country, then you're going to end up arresting people who are disproportionately, if not entirely, of one ethnicity. She was responding to that allegation from the public defender. She was not making their ethnicity or their nationality a point herself.
Okay. Randy Shaw, let me turn back to you here for a second. You just heard Leighton describe a very professionalized drug trade, right? Starting with the Sinaloa cartel and then the very targeted trafficking of Honduran nationals into the United States, and a business-like operation on the streets of places like the Tenderloin. Does that track with sort of what you have seen in the parts of the Tenderloin that have that sort of thriving open-air drug market these days?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, I've posted on Twitter photos of people they open the trunk of their car and they deliver the lunches to the drug dealers who eat their lunch so they can stay on the post. And all of this was documented by the former U.S. Attorney of San Francisco, David Anderson. And it was all out in the media and before COVID. And it somehow it's been like forgotten, all of the research and findings about the Honduran connection. But as Leighton points out, it's a professional cartel. And the question is, they would not be allowed on other San Francisco streets. They're only allowed in poor multiracial neighborhoods. So you have these quote unquote progressive elected officials who say they care about a population, but they really care more about not arresting drug dealers. And our San Francisco Chronicle newspaper is against what they call aggressive law enforcement, which is crazy because you're thinking, we have low-income families who are in jeopardy. They can't even walk safely down their street. And yet, if you arrest the drug dealers, you're involved in a war on drugs. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you, Meghna? It doesn't make sense to us.
Well, I'm reading that some progressive critics are saying that, well, and in fact, this was even not this year, it was a couple of years ago, saying that more aggressive law enforcement of drug dealers in San Francisco was, they equated that to an end run around sanctuary city. Mm-hmm. Regulations in the city. It was just a way that they were saying that law enforcement was using to deport undocumented immigrants. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's rather remarkable, and if people must shake their heads and marvel at how a city like San Francisco thinks it's totally fine for people to sell drugs, lethal drugs, because remember, the drugs being sold are responsible for the overdose deaths with the fentanyl. So it's not even like they're just selling heroin without fentanyl in the old days. They're selling murderous drugs associated with violence and shootings. And they're saying, let's keep that going because otherwise we're jeopardizing our sanctuary city status. I mean, how can anyone take that seriously?
Hmm. Well, Randy, I've got one more question for you before I have to let you go. You had said earlier that you hold not only city law enforcement responsible, but even Mayor Breed herself, that she keeps talking about this, but not directing more resources to the Tenderloin. So what do you think the neighborhood needs right now to really get a handle on the situation?
Well, just last week, the mayor announced an $8.5 million investment in community ambassadors, unarmed ambassadors in various parts, but they don't deal with open drug markets. She could have taken that same $8.5 million and either have off-duty police officers or armed security guards on the handful of blocks in the Tenderloin where the dealers are operating and could have cleared that out. So when you see money being spent for things that don't close open drug markets, it's hard to understand how the mayor's words are at match with actions, because they have not been.
Well, Randy Shaw, director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, a nonprofit supportive housing provider. He also runs a blog called beyondcron.org. Randy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Leighton, let me turn back to you. Why Honduras? Why does the Sinaloa cartel go to Honduras and recruit young dealers?
It's a really good question. I have not found an answer to that question yet, and I have asked around, and I plan to do some further reporting into. I don't know why. I mean, I could speculate as to why there is organized criminal activity in Central America, as everybody knows. There's a criminal element there who prey upon regular everyday Hondurans who would be good foot soldiers in this business. But I don't know for sure why the Sinaloa cartel targets Honduras specifically and not, you know, the same similar types of areas in Mexico or El Salvador or Guatemala.
And so can you just tell us a little bit more about how much this has changed from, I don't know, 5 years ago in terms of the kinds of drugs that were flowing into San Francisco? Or is it just heightened because of demand and the collapse of the local economy, in a sense, as Randy was describing?
It's gotten far worse. And there's the couple of key reasons, I believe, are, as Randy pointed out, first of all, COVID-19 and the emptying of the streets downtown, which created this sort of vacuum that was filled by the open air drug market, which already existed in the Tenderloin, but then spilled out into Soma and other neighboring districts. So that's one big reason. The other big reason is fentanyl. Fentanyl has been on the East Coast for quite a few years, but it's relatively new to the West Coast. And now it's cut into everything. So if you get, if you buy cocaine, if you buy heroin, if you buy methamphetamines on the street, the chances are it's cut with fentanyl, which is a very deadly drug and highly, highly, highly addictive. And so fentanyl, so it's killing more people and it's addicting people like crazy. And not just cocaine and methamphetamines and things like that. There's children who, you know, teenagers who buy Xanax on Snapchat. What they get is something that's either cut with fentanyl or sometimes it's pure fentanyl. And they end up getting hooked. And some of those people, kids end up in the Tenderloin. So this plague of this new, highly potent, highly toxic opioid is another part of the reason.
Okay. So I just want to reiterate what you've described. You've described, a very powerful Mexican cartel recruiting dealers from Honduras, bringing them across the border into various cities, including San Francisco, housing them. I think I heard you say they're housing them in Oakland across the bay, right? And working in the Tenderloin. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And then even being so organized to the point where Randy had mentioned that, there's basically a lunch truck that goes around various streets in the Tenderloin to deliver lunch to the dealers so that they don't have to leave their posts. Now, if it's so relatively clearly understood, can you tell me in detail, Leighton, what, if anything, has San Francisco law enforcement done? Because my understanding was, a couple of years ago, there was actually a federal initiative in the Tenderloin to do something about the drug trade.
Yeah, well, under the DA, two DAs ago, George Gascon, who's now DA in LA, there were some sting operations that were undertaken that were effective. And these are sting operations around both drug dealing and also fencing, which is the larceny industry, which is part of the backbone to the drug dealing industry, because the people have to steal property in order to raise the money to buy the drugs. So this stuff is all interconnected. That stuff effectively stopped under the prior DA, Chesa Boudin, and police stopped making arrests under the prior DA. Now, there's a combination of factors. There was the fact that the DA was not prosecuting these cases, and there's also a law on the books that was passed in 2014, Prop 47, which effectively decriminalized drug possession and shoplifting. So these things became if all you can get is a misdemeanor charge, then cops usually don't bother making those arrests. Now, I don't want to let the cops off the hook altogether, because these are the reasons that they'll give you as to why they stopped making arrests. But the reality is they could have continued to make arrests. They could have at least had foot patrols in the Tenderloin and had just had a presence. So I do not exonerate the police for their failure even under the prior DA to do anything about this. From what I'm hearing from people I've interviewed, the new DA took over, Brooke Jenkins, things have changed incrementally. The police are making arrests. It hasn't changed dramatically. It still looks more or less the same as it did before, but things have been improving. I've talked to people in the Soma neighborhood, for example, who used to have to weave their way through drug dealers and step over users to get into their apartment buildings, who say, the blocks are now largely clear with a couple of stragglers, a couple of users here and there, a couple of dealers here and there, but it's not nearly what it used to be. So things are changing slowly.
Okay. Now, the former prosecutor Boudin, he was recalled.
Correct.
Right. That was by the voters of the city of San Francisco.
Right, by a 10-point margin.
By a 10-point margin. Okay. What was the reason why the number of arrests went down or prosecutions went down under him?
Well, Chesa Boudin was he intent, and he campaigned on this. He was intent on not charging people, not arrest. Well, he charged people, but he didn't prosecute those cases under the charges in which they were what they were guilty of. So, for example, if you were a drug dealer, he might charge you with criminal loitering or something like that, something that bumped the charge down to either a misdemeanor or a offense that did not trigger deportation charges. So in Chesabedin's opinion, many of these drug dealers were human trafficking victims. I've looked into this. I've talked to many people about this, and the evidence does not bear that claim out. But he believed that he was protecting these folks from deportation, and that, or at least that's what he said.
Well, Leighton Woodhouse, stand by for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to talk more about sort of what lessons San Francisco holds for other cities that are also dealing with this sharp rise in deadly fentanyl on their streets. So we'll do that when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a little heads up about something we're working on for tomorrow. We're going to be asking why most customer service has become pretty terrible. So do you have horror stories about dealing with, say, your cable or wireless provider? Have you tried to get customer service from the little bot that pops up when you go online to your wireless provider? Have you made any inroads on the phone when trying to get some help? We want to hear your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Looking for people with frustrating stories of customer service. And if you've ever worked at a call center, would love to hear from you too. 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow. Today, we're talking about what's happened with the drug trade in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, and specifically trying to understand the system that brings both drugs and drug dealers into the United States and how that's grown over the past several years, and what it means for efforts to try to curb the opioid epidemic in America. I'm joined today by Leighton Woodhouse. He's a freelance journalist in the Bay Area who's reported extensively on the drug trade in the Tenderloin. He's with us from Oakland. And now I'd like to bring Sam Quiñones into the conversation. He joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. He has written for years about America's drug epidemics, including Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, award-winning 2015 book, and The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, which is out in paperback this week. Sam, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, I would love to hear your analysis of fentanyl in particular, because as Leighton did point out, it's been a problem, a serious problem in the eastern United States for a while, spreading west now. Where is the actual substance, the actual fentanyl coming from?
It's coming from Mexico. It's coming from certain parts of Mexico, mostly on the west coast, Sinaloa area, the state of Jalisco, Michoacan, places like that. And it's coming from those areas because there's a very sophisticated drug trafficking culture that has existed for decades in those areas. They have discovered fentanyl, which they discovered, as I told the story in The Least of Us, when the Sinaloa drug cartel discovered fentanyl was about 2006 due to an underground chemist they had hired. But another crucial reason for why it's coming out of there is because there are two massive shipping ports through which they can get all the ingredients that they would need to make fentanyl and meth, which is also part of this story, from the world chemical markets, China, India, wherever. And so you get unending, relentless supplies of these ingredients, and more and more people in that area have learned how to make this and become very sophisticated at it. And so the supplies of meth, but especially fentanyl, as we're talking about now, have just exploded. And what you're seeing is really because of those factors I mentioned, you were seeing that area of Mexico essentially cover the country, an unprecedented act. We've never seen that before, where one source has really covered the United States with not one but two of the most dangerous drugs we've ever seen on our streets, meth, but and as I say, fentanyl as well. And you see fentanyl, I think fentanyl really started in the Midwest. The areas where the opioid epidemic hit first, mm-hmm. Ohio, Kentucky, places like that. And then it went east and west. And so in California, I think the first mass overdose to fentanyl was in Chico at about 2018, roughly. Nobody died. But since then, as Leighton says, has expanded and is now pretty much all over the western United States and into, of course, San Francisco.
So I want to slowly work our way north here in this analysis, but first of all, what is the impact on the Mexican people living in the parts of the country where the Sinaloa cartel is manufacturing so much meth and fentanyl?
Well, any drug industry, by definition, changes the economics of the area, generally forces prices up. People, of course, die from working in fentanyl labs because they breathe in the dust. I would say that it has also done a remarkable job of effectively destroying the opium poppy industry in certain parts of western Mexico. It used to be that industry has existed for decades, and really there's almost no market for opium, which you can turn into heroin, anymore. It's really all been simply displaced by and outcompeted, you might say, by fentanyl. And that's also borne out up here, where we also see virtually very, very little heroin anymore on the streets of America. It's all been crowded out and outcompeted by fentanyl.
Mm. And so then moving closer to the United States here, Leighton described in detail how the Sinaloa cartel, for reasons that we don't quite fully understand yet, are recruiting dealers from Honduras. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that, Sam.
Well, I think the Honduran business model has existed for many years. Okay. When I was writing Dreamland, I was in Denver and Portland, and clearly the Hondurans were operating. It's generally a foot traffic business model where guys are just posting up on a street corner. They're not in cars or anything like that. I think the connection between the Sinaloans and the Mexican traffickers in general and the Honduran traffickers evolved because that was their source. They don't really make much heroin as far as I know down in Honduras. It's mostly made in the western side of Mexico. And so they needed to rely on them for sourcing. And so it kind of evolved over time. The current state of affairs with regard to the Hondurans, I would defer to other people. Mm-hmm. I think your U.S. attorney in San Francisco might be a good place to start with that. But my experience with the Honduran business model is that it has been around for a lot of years. And I'm talking about going back to 2009 when I first saw them, 2010, I think it was. And my impression from narcotics officers was that predated that by a good number of years. So it's been around for a while. I would say, like any of those organizations, they operate on how much risk is actually involved. And when people perceive there is no risk to what they are doing, selling open air drugs in an open air environment, or being arrested and then quickly released, the word spreads, and it's much easier to recruit workers when you can tell them and truthfully that really, you know, as they say in Mexico, no pasa nada, nothing's going to happen. Hmm. When I was writing about the business model, the Mexican trafficking business model that I wrote about in Dreamland, of a village where everyone sold heroin up here in the United States, very much like pizza delivery. That was clearly a recruiting tool that they use. You can come up here, you'll be arrested, but nothing's going to happen. They'll deport you maybe. And people would join up thinking that was what was going to happen to them. And very often it did.
Okay. Well, you know how you heard Leighton a few minutes ago point out that part of the reason why the nothing's going to happen word might have been spreading is because there was a reluctance, specifically in San Francisco, from some progressive leaders to really crack down because, you know, the former prosecutor Boudin made the argument that some of these dealers were themselves victims of human trafficking. And so therefore, a different approach to law enforcement was necessary. I mean, what do you think about that, Sam?
Well, I don't know the truth of whether how many of those folks are trafficked and how many of them volunteer. I would say Honduras is a place that a lot of people are very eager to leave right now. So I'm not sure how much of that has to be in terms of trafficked people. I would say that part of the issue that we're dealing with right now is that there has been a reluctance on the part of certain in certain cities, but I think in various parts of the country, to use law enforcement in its traditional roles, because we believe that that's a return somehow to the drug war. The drug war, it's important to understand, the problems the drug war had did not come because of we used law enforcement. It's because we only used law enforcement, and that was the only solution to all of it. And I think we have changed dramatically. That does not mean that that law enforcement doesn't have a pivotal, crucial role in supply interdiction, in being in imposing the kind of risks that low-level dealers like you might be seeing in San Francisco, although I don't know Tenderloin. I used to work in Tenderloin. I wrote for a newspaper in the Tenderloin for a while, but those were decades ago, so it's been a while since I've been there. But I think that we need to understand that people in those operations do respond to risk and consequences, and if there are none, they also respond to that as well.
Okay. Really interesting point. So, Leighton Woodhouse, let me bring you back in here, and I appreciate you listening with me to Sam. You know, Leighton, a couple of minutes ago, Randy Shaw, who works in the Tenderloin, had been saying that, you know, part of the problem was that things the drug trade grew and was pushed out into the open air because so many businesses had closed in the Tenderloin. So I'm wondering what you think, along with an increase in law enforcement, as Sam just pointed out, if that cannot and should not be the only solution, what else needs to happen in the Tenderloin?
Well, the first thing that needs to happen is, as we've remarked, you know, arresting the drug dealers, in my opinion. But there are, of course, many, many other that need to take place. Some of them already are being implemented in San Francisco. There's much more treatment available than there used to be. I think the wrong mix of treatment. For example, you know, harm reduction is sort of the prevailing philosophy in San Francisco, and harm reduction is basically premised on the idea that you need to keep people alive in order for them to be able to be steered to recovery. Obviously, nobody can recover if they're dead. And so this is the philosophy around things like needle exchange, safe consumption sites, passing out naloxone, which is an anti-opioid sort of remedy, and things like that. But in San Francisco, people aren't pushed towards recovery. They're just they're given the implements and the oversight to stay alive, but then they're just left where they are. I think there needs to be a much more aggressive push towards opening beds in recovery centers where people can detox and rehabilitate with the assistance with medically assisted treatment. They can go on Suboxone, they can go on methadone and things like that. But unfortunately, there's no medication for meth. But where they can be treated and brought to a point of functionality and ultimately sobriety, and that is not at all being pushed in San Francisco. It's very much about just handing out needles, handing out foils, naloxone, and that's it. That's kind of where it ends in terms of treatment in San Francisco.
Okay, so more treatment, not just harm reduction, more law enforcement, as you've said several times, Leighton. Sam, is there any place in the United States. I mean, there are many places that are obviously also suffering from this flood of deadly fentanyl, but that's catching up in terms of trying on how to reduce its impact.
I would say that one thing that the fentanyl issue has brought up, and so has the meth, is that these drugs do a magnificent, masterful job of squelching users' instinct for self-preservation. That's what you see in tent encampments all the time. People saying, no, I don't want to leave, even though they're being pimped out, beaten, they're facing lethal temperatures and so on. So I think one thing that is these two drugs on the street and the supplies and potency that they are, that they exist today, are requiring us, demanding that we rethink jail. Jail has been a negative for so long. It can be a positive. You're finding places in the Midwest that are really expanding recovery options and making jail pods into places of recovery. Jail also happens to be a place where once you are arrested, you can't leave. And so you have a blessed respite from dope. And this is happening in certain counties in the Midwest, where you're finding people spending time away from the street, recovering, not able to leave, which is so important because these drugs will take you and push you to find them regardless of the risk or the cost of even your own life. So in my opinion, my reporting has convinced me, frankly, that we need to rethink jail on a mass scale. Jail has always been kind of a reflection today of this kind of throw away the key attitude that we had for many, many years. It's just so counterproductive, so damaging. And I think increasingly in places where they've been dealing with the opioid epidemic for a long time, you are finding jailers there, particularly in Kentucky, seems to be a leader in all this, where jailers were thinking, you know, we need to do something different. We need to pay attention as jailers to what happens to people when they leave our jail. And that is a radical idea in the United States. Never have jailers spent at least a second thinking about what happens to people when they leave. The Least of Us has three chapters on that I wrote about a jail in Kentucky where they're doing this. It's experimental. They're still struggling to find the proper mix sometimes. But I think given the drugs on the street are so deadly, there's no such thing as a long-term fentanyl user. Everybody dies. Because of that, we need to find a place where people can stay and can't leave until they kind of have the break from the drugs that their brains require.
But Sam, just briefly, because I do also want to give one last word to Leighton here. Just give me a 10-second response to this, Sam. When a lot of people hearing you say this are going to be like, wait, how can incarceration at all be a solution to...
it's a solution. It can be a solution.
Okay.
Absolutely. I would say visit the jails that are doing this. Columbus, Ohio is opening a big jail, which I have not visited yet, that's doing just this. People have gotten sober in jail forever. It's a major way people get sober in jail. The problem is jail as a whole has been a very definite negative, been life mangling for a lot of people. We need to change that part of it. We need to find ways to enhance the recovery potential. Yeah. And I think that's what you're finding in some jails in the Midwest.
Well, Leighton, I'm sorry. We only have about 20 seconds left here. How can San Francisco get a handle on this problem for as long as there seems to be progressive infighting amongst leaders in the city?
I think things are changing with Brooke Jenkins as DA. I'm happy to see it. And I just want to reiterate what Randy said, which I just interviewed a woman yesterday from Mexico, an immigrant who lives in the Tenderloin. She wants more police. So this allegation that crackdown on Latino drug dealers is some racist and standing up for working class Latinos is not just wrong, but I think it's racist to conflate regular immigrant families with drug dealers.
Well, Leighton Woodhouse, a Bay Area freelance journalist who's been covering the Tenderloin for some time. Thank you so much for joining us, Leighton. And Sam Quiñones, author of Dreamland and The Least of Us. Sam, great to have you. Thank you so much. This is On Point.